Today at Reader's Corner, Martin Ford, author of Rise of the Robots, Technology and the Threat of a Jobless Future. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Imagine a world where you are driven to work in a driverless car, your morning news is written by a computer, and your lunch is prepared by a robot. In such a world, it would not be a stretch to wonder if humans were about to become obsolete. We've already seen this scenario play out in movies and popular novels, but according to today's guest, there are reasons to worry about how new technologies are reshaping the real world right now. Martin Ford is the founder of a Silicon Valley-based software development firm and the author of Rise of the Robots, Technology and the Threat of a Jobless Future. In his latest book, Mr. Ford makes the case that technology is advancing so quickly that robots and computers soon will be able to do nearly all of our jobs. And these days, they are not just replacing muscle, he tells us, but also brain power. Unless we find a way to tackle this complex issue, the result could be vast unemployment and a broken economy. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Martin Ford. He has degrees in computer engineering and business and more than 25 years of experience in computer design and software development. Rise of the Robots won the 2015 Financial Times McKinsey Business Book of the Year Award and has been translated into 19 languages. It's now out in paperback. Mr. Ford joins us on Skype for this interview. Martin Ford, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Martin, in one respect, I would think you're an unlikely suspect to write a book like this. You, after all, have these degrees in computer engineering, your careers in software development. You've been hanging out with technology now for your entire life and career. Does it seem odd to you that you're the guy to uncover this for us?
Well, not necessarily. I'm certainly not the first one to talk about this issue. It's an issue that's been raised, you know, many times
sure.
in the past. But I'm very close to the technology, so I've seen what's happened just in my own business and also, you know, what's happening more globally. So I think that certainly gives me a perspective on this.
I mentioned the driverless car. Give us some other examples of just how advanced this technology is. And by the way, the driverless car, obviously, thanks to Google, that's been in the media a lot. And I've even seen the video of the driverless car driving down the street. But beyond that, some of the things we don't see as far as advances in technology, machine learning, artificial intelligence, give us some examples of what's going on out there.
Well, yeah, there is tremendous progress broadly in artificial intelligence and in particular in a specific area that's called deep learning. And basically what that involves is building neural networks or computing systems that are roughly modeled on the human brain. And that's an idea that's been around for a long time. But recently, we've seen just tremendous breakthroughs there. And we now have systems that, from companies like Google and Microsoft that, for example, can recognize visual images better than human beings. And that's really just an amazing thing because the ability to look at an image and interpret that and in general to recognize patterns is something that humans are just extraordinarily good at. And it's one of the areas that really has set us apart. But we're now beginning to see smart algorithms, artificial intelligence systems that are competing with people. Microsoft, actually their Skype division demonstrated a deep learning system that was able to do a rough job of translating Mandarin Chinese to English in real time, like a real-time translation system, which is something that is basically straight out of Star Trek. You know, that's like the universal translator. So we're beginning to see things that just a few years ago were literally science fiction that are, you know, becoming realized. And this is happening really quite rapidly. So I do expect just dramatic progress to continue over the next couple of decades.
And I think you mentioned that even the TV game Jeopardy saw artificial intelligence up close and personal.
That's right. I mean, IBM, pretty famously, they had their Watson system, which actually was able to prevail at that. And, you know, that was a fairly specific technology. But the amazing thing was that they were able to build a machine that could handle all of this natural language, that could deal with, you know, language the way that people use it, delving even into things like jokes and puns and so forth. That's really quite remarkable. So we're really beginning to see some unprecedented things in terms of what's being done with artificial intelligence.
What jobs are most at risk when it comes to who loses their job and who hangs on?
Well, the general rule is going to be that it's jobs that are on some level more routine, repetitive, and predictable. In other words, if you've got a job where the things that you do every day can be predicted based on what you've done in the past, then that's probably a job that's going to be susceptible to this. And the key technology is machine learning. That's the idea that a smart algorithm is going to be able to churn through lots of historical data, for example, and based on that, figure out what to do in the future. And the thing to understand is that that's a lot of jobs. I mean, a lot of people in our economy come to work and they do the same kinds of things again and again, not necessarily rote repetitive, but broadly, you know, they do things that are predictable based on what they've done in the past. So a high percentage of jobs.
Right. While we're on this subject, let's talk for a moment about your New York Times article that you wrote in June of 2015 about China's robot revolution. In some ways, China's even more disadvantaged, I guess, as you explain in your book as well, since we're talking mainly about manufacturing. Help us understand that point.
Right. Of course, manufacturing is really the first area where we've really seen robots. I mean, you know, people tend to associate robots with factories. In advanced countries like the United States, you know, manufacturing in terms of employment isn't really that important anymore. You know, most people work in the service sector, but clearly that's not the case in China. China, you know, is incredibly dependent on manufacturing as a way to employ just an enormous number of people in its factories. And yet they are sort of caught in a paradox. They can see that in the future, if they don't automate their factories, then, you know, those factories are likely to come back to countries like the United States because we can build automated factories here. That's part of what's happening with reshoring. So China is in the process of automating their factories. They're bringing robots into their factories because they don't want to lose that manufacturing, either having it reshore to the United States and other advanced countries, or perhaps even go to even lower wage countries like Indonesia. So as they automate their factories, it means that there are going to be fewer jobs there, especially for unskilled people, when there are just an enormous numbers of those people there that still rely on those jobs. So it may eventually create something of a paradox for them in terms of how they continue to employ so many people.
Can we find large communities in China where people are out of work, where the unemployment rate is higher than you would think because of this particular development?
Well, you know, the threat of unemployment in China is always, you know, something that is rather terrifying. You know, right now we don't see that, but they're very heavily dependent on economic growth. I mean, China is a country that has been growing at a rate of 7% or more, you know, for a very long time, which is just incredible relative to what we see in countries like the United States. And it's becoming a real question whether they can continue to grow that fast. I mean, their economy is clearly slowing down. The factories are beginning to incorporate robots. So I think it's a real concern whether they're going to be able to employ so many people in the future. You know, there's a real threat there of potential unemployment.
Your book really gets a bit scary when you start talking about job creation in the United States. And I'd like you to share with us what has happened in this area during the course of our recovery from the Great Recession.
Well, I mean, what we've seen over the last few decades is that every decade basically produces fewer jobs in percentage terms than the previous decade. So there's an ongoing long-term trend there toward, you know, less effective job creation in the economy. And I think that that certainly is tied in some measure to what's happening with technology. This last decade, the first decade of this century, was just a disaster. I mean, we didn't actually create any new jobs over the course of that first decade. Since then, we are recovering somewhat. But there's also something going on with the quality of the jobs being produced. What's happening is the economy, to the extent that it is creating jobs, is creating really what you might think of as lousy jobs, you know, really low-wage jobs in the service sector and far fewer good, solid, middle-class jobs. So we're really seeing the job market being hollowed out. When a recession does happen, the first jobs to get wiped out are the good, solid, middle-class jobs that provide people with a decent middle-class income. So those jobs disappear. And then it's taking longer and longer for the jobs to come back. And when they do come back, the jobs that we're getting are very often, you know, fast food and retail jobs that pay minimum wage and often aren't even full-time and don't have much in the way of benefits. So we are seeing kind of a collapse in the quality of jobs as well, and that's a real concern going forward.
You're listening to Reader's Corner, and my guest is Martin Ford, author of Rise of the Robots, Technology and the Threat of a Jobless Future. Mr. Ford is the founder of a Silicon Valley-based software firm, and he has many years of experience in software development and computer design. I guess another way of looking at this is the statistic you used, where in, I think it was 1998, there were 194 billion hours of labor. And now take us up to the current year or last year.
2013. Yeah, there were exactly the same number. I mean, there were still 194 billion hours of labor in the business sector of the U.S. economy. So over those 15 years, you know, actually the output generated by the business sector grew by about 42% or $3.5 trillion. So there was an incredible increase of the amount of stuff produced. And during that same 15 years, the population of the United States grew by 40 million people. So there were a huge number of people entering the workforce. And yet, there was no increase at all in the amount of human labor in terms of the number of hours in that business sector. So, I mean, that's kind of scary. I mean, it really suggests that businesses are using technology to produce much more, but they're really doing it on the basis of technology and not on the basis of human labor.
So to bring this a little closer to home for me in my other job as a university president, what about wages for new college graduates?
Well, what we've seen over the last decade is that those have actually declined in real terms. So, you know, there is, of course, a story out there which is true, which is that if you want to have a chance of having a middle class lifestyle, you better go to college, because if you stop at high school, things are looking really bad. So it's much better to go to college than not to go to college. But the other side of that is that even though that's true, it's not because things are fantastic for college graduates. In fact, college graduates are seeing declining incomes. The truth of the matter is that it's better to go to college, because if you don't go to college, then things are really genuinely in collapse. You know, it's really just a disaster for people that only have a high school education. So, you know, it's really a concern. And I think part of what's happening here is that technology is climbing that skills ladder, that robots and smart algorithms are beginning to encroach on the kinds of work that are, you know, being taken by college graduates. So it's not just low-skilled work anymore.
When we hear word of an industry letting up on job creation, when we hear that there's no more jobs in this sector of the economy versus another sector, the typical response from either state government, sometimes the federal government, and universities is, well, we'll just shift all of our resources over to, let's say, the STEM disciplines, or shift it wherever there's a particular need. We'll retool, we'll bring people back in. Comment on whether you think that's going to be effective in the years to come.
Well, right. That's been the historical approach. And to some extent, of course, it will work. I mean, there's no doubt that there's what we call a process of creative destruction. And technology will destroy industries or wipe out the jobs in particular industries the way, for example, it did in agriculture, right? I mean, there used to be millions of jobs in agriculture, and now most of those jobs are gone. Nearly all of them are gone. And technology will create new industries as well. You can think of what some of those are going to be, things like nanotechnology and synthetic biology and so forth. But there's a lot of evidence to suggest that while there will be new industries that will arise in the future, they're simply not going to employ many people. So the problem we have going forward is that this technology has really become broad-based. It's invading the whole economy now. It's not just hitting in specific sectors. It's become a true general-purpose technology. And what that means is that a lot of traditional employment areas are going to be disrupted. And there will be new things that will arise, but they probably just are not going to be many opportunities there. One study that I saw just recently suggests that right now in the United States, about 90% of our workforce works in occupations that existed 100 years ago. You know, it's things like driving vehicles, working in offices, working in factories, working in healthcare, working in retail stores, working in food preparation. These are all jobs that someone in 1915 would have recognized. And yet what we see is that, you know, clearly these technologies are poised to have massive disruption in those areas. I mean, just take, for an example, self-driving cars. I mean, what is that going to mean for all of the people that now have jobs driving vehicles. So we can see this coming, and we know that there certainly will be new occupations created, and you know, there are examples you can point to: website designers, social media marketers, data scientists. These are all new professions that didn't exist just a few decades ago. But as I said, there are a relatively small number of employment. You know, 90% of the people are working in areas that existed 100 years ago. So the concern we have going forward is that as those traditional areas get disrupted, there will be new things come up, but probably not enough to absorb all of the people that are going to be impacted in traditional employment areas.
I must say that while I found your argument compelling, there were moments when I had to question whether it's all going to pan out exactly as folks have predicted. And let's just take the driverless car. I don't know. Maybe I'm naive and maybe I'm just a guy that likes to get behind the wheel. But I've got to wonder 50 years from now, or maybe a lot sooner than that, I guess, whether or not there's going to be a major debate in America about whether or not there should be driverless cars. All you're going to have is one or two screw-ups out there where some computer goes awry, and before you know it, you're going to have the Tea Party coming after, going into government and going after driverless cars, or people just not buying them because they don't trust them. I mean, it seems like there's a lot of unknowns out there that doesn't make this argument of this scary future as for sure as maybe some think it is.
Right. I mean, and in truth, I'm, you know, maybe much more humble about this than you might think. I mean, certainly I'm not trying to make any precise predictions at all. The only thing I'm trying to do is capture the trend that I think is going to be important. And in terms of the details of exactly how it's going to play out, I mean, no reasonable person can purport to predict the future. I mean, everyone has tried to do that in the past, has failed. So I don't know exactly how all of this is going to play out. Definitely in, you know, speaking specifically about driverless cars, you're right. There are lots of issues there in terms of regulation, in terms of social acceptance. But clearly the technology is just taking off at a remarkable pace, and it's incredible how fast it's unfolded. I mean, you know, I wrote my first book about this back in 2009, and at that point I never imagined that driverless cars would be feasible by now. I thought that that was something that probably lied much further in the future. And yet, you know, Google has demonstrated a viable technology, and now virtually every auto manufacturer, companies like Uber and Lyft are now jumping on it. Tesla is in it. Apple Computer even is getting into this realm. So there's just this incredible momentum there. I mean, it's clearly going to result in something going on there. And you're right, there will be people that will resist it. People like to drive, for example. So that will be an issue. One thing I would say, though, that I think it's very likely that in the long run, driverless cars are going to prove to be safer than human beings because they're going to be much more consistent. One thing that I think will happen is that in terms of commercial drivers, you know, think in terms of a big company that employs lots of people to drive. That company sees right now just incredible levels of liability. I mean, it's a scary situation. If one of their drivers messes up, I mean, they face potential enormous liability. So once these technologies are proven to be safer and to produce fewer accidents, I think that there will be a tremendous incentive for big companies at least to really move to this technology quite rapidly, just if nothing else from a liability standpoint. So there could actually be tremendous momentum there in areas where people are actually employed to drive, more so than individuals, you know, buying self-driving cars. Mm-hmm. So I do think that will very likely be an important trend, and it could have a huge impact on employment.
I'm Bob Custer, and I'm speaking today with Martin Ford about his book, Rise of the Robots. In the book, Mr. Ford looks at how new technologies are changing the workplace landscape as computers and robots take on more and more tasks formerly done by humans. You talked earlier about the fact that the jobs that are really at risk are the routine jobs. And when I think of the non-routine jobs, one of them, until I got to the middle of your book anyway, one of the things that I think about is writing and sports report or reporting, period, journalism and folks watching a baseball game or a football game and recording what's going on and handing it off to the editor in a way it goes online or in the daily newspaper the next morning. And yet you tell us about StatsMonkey and what it's doing it sounds to me like that's going to put some sports reporters out of work.
Right. I mean, definitely there are companies that have developed some very sophisticated systems. And essentially what they do is they look at information, at data that's available. And it might be information about a sports game, or it might be earnings reports for companies, you know, in the business world. And these systems are able to take that data and then translate it into a compelling narrative. They can write a story about it. And so this is something that's already being used by big media companies to write stories. And right now, it's the more formulaic areas, things like business reporting or sports reporting. But it's getting better and better. And, you know, ultimately, this is a technology that will roll out far beyond just reporting. I mean, you can imagine really any kind of white-collar job where you're in a company doing something that's relatively routine, you know, taking information and writing a report about that, or doing some kind of analysis on a routine basis. All of that is going to be susceptible to white-collar automation. So again, this is something that is going to have a very broad-based, significant impact. And the impact is going to be on people that have lots of education. It's not going to be just, you know, unskilled, uneducated people. It's going to be people that have got a college degree, perhaps, and are doing a job that involves the manipulation of information. A lot of these jobs are going to be quite susceptible. So That's something that really kind of upends our conventional view about all of this, which is always, you know, the solution is education. If you're educated, you don't have to worry. I think that will change in the future.
There are two areas, two sectors of the economy where you're not as sure of the future, or at least you acknowledge the fact that technology hasn't really grabbed hold of these industries the way it has in other areas, and that's education and healthcare. Let's take those one at a time. Talk to us about the healthcare industry.
Well, healthcare, I mean, there definitely will be technology that will have a dramatic impact. I mean, in my book, I talk about, for example, artificial intelligence used in medicine for diagnosis and for treatment and so forth. That's going to be very important. It will be a powerful tool. And I think that we can see some real progress there. But there are some areas of medicine that really are very, very difficult to automate currently. And one area, for example, would be nursing. I mean, to be a nurse requires a combination of mobility, dexterity, interaction with patients, intellectual capability in terms of problem solving. All of those things put together in one package are just really, really difficult for a machine to reproduce. So I think it's going to be a long time before we have a robot that can do what a nurse can do. That's something that still really remains science fiction. And so as a result, those kinds of areas of medicine where you have that combination of dexterity and interacting with patients and intellectual capability are going to be really hard to automate. Those jobs are going to be relatively safe for, you know, the foreseeable future. So if I were to talk to a college student and that student asked me what, you know, should I study? I would say healthcare is definitely one good bet if you want a safe career path. Mm-hmm. So the impact there is going to be a bit more marginal than it is in areas like manufacturing, for example.
And as far as higher education is concerned, you spent quite a bit of time in your book talking about how you might grade electronically. And then also you addressed the issue of these MOOCs, the massive online courses that really haven't yet taken off. I mean, they're out there, but they're just, as you point out in your book, not enough people using them. And it has a lot to do, I guess, with the resistance of faculty and others in higher education. Help us understand that.
When the MOOCs first appeared, there was a lot of hype. You know, people thought, wow, this is just going to totally transform everything. And that really hasn't happened. But I wouldn't say that it won't happen. I mean, the technology is developing. One of the real challenges is to have some sort of a credential, you know, on the basis of these online courses. I mean, the real key to it from the perspective of students is, you know, if I invest in online education and using some of this technology, am I going to get a credential that employers will accept? You know, can it lead to a career? And if we get to the point where that becomes true, then I do think it has the potential to be very disruptive. So far, that hasn't happened, but there's lots and lots of work that continues on it. We're beginning to see, for example, what you might think of as robotic tutors that are able to give students individualized attention and really help them progress through these courses. And as that gets better and better, I think that there is the potential for a disruption. And, you know, if that happens, it's going to be kind of, as I say in the book, a dual-edged sword. I mean, on the one hand, it will be very positive in the sense that it will make education much more accessible to everyone and probably less expensive. But the other side of that is that there are a huge number of people out there that work in the educational field, that have a career there. And if that whole sector of the economy gets disrupted, then, you know, a lot of jobs are going to be on the line there as well. So it's sort of an interesting phenomenon. We'll have to see how it plays out over the next couple of decades.
Let's talk about the solution. If we assume then that in a certain year, and I believe you did predict that if the worst comes to worst, we could be seeing massive unemployment by, what, 2050 or somewhere in that neighborhood?
Yeah, I mean, I don't make exact predictions. There are a couple of studies that have been done, for example, at Oxford University. They looked at the jobs in the United States and they came to the conclusion that about half of them could potentially be automated within the next two decades. Mm-hmm. So that's one sort of, you know, rough estimate. But the only thing I would say is that if we look forward 10, 20, 30 years, it could be a major, major impact. And it doesn't matter so much whether it's going to be a quarter of the jobs or half of the jobs. Any of those numbers would just be a staggering impact. So, I mean, I think it could potentially be a big deal.
So that brings us to what are we going to do about it? And I have to say that I was a little taken back by your response here. It's a very interesting one. It's not completely new, as you point out. Friedrich Hayek figured this out a long time ago. But share with us just how you see this working in a leisure society, I guess you might call it, where vast numbers of people are not fully employed.
Right. Well, I mean, the key issue is that right now, jobs are a package deal, right? Your job gives you something to do and a sense of accomplishment, and it also gives you an income. So in the future, I think we may have to figure out a way to decouple those two things so that people still have that sense of purpose and fulfillment, but their income might not necessarily come from a job. And one way to approach that is to have something like a guaranteed minimum income or a basic income where everyone in our society has got access to at least a minimal livable income, whether they work in a traditional job or not. And, you know, that's kind of politically an unthinkable idea right now, certainly in the United States, but it is an idea that's getting more traction. More people are thinking about it. Actually, in Finland, that country is actually thinking about implementing this quite seriously right now. So it's an idea that across the world is getting more traction. And I think that in a future where jobs are harder to come by and where there may just not be enough jobs to go around to give everyone who needs an income, it's an idea that we may have to begin to view seriously. And I think that's what the future may bring, even though it's hard to kind of imagine that at this point.
So I did mention Friedrich Hayek because he was a conservative economist, and he's really the godfather of the conservative movement in many respects when it comes to economics. And you're pointing out that if you have trouble with conservatives, there is no question that a guaranteed annual income will have trouble with conservatives. So when that day comes, your point is, I guess, that go back and read Hayek and he'll help us out here.
That's right. I mean, it's an idea that's been around for a while. It's been proposed on other bases than technology. I'm saying that technology is going to make it even more important in the future, but certainly other people have proposed it previously. And the reason they proposed it is that it is a conservative, market-oriented, libertarian approach to a welfare system. I mean, rather than having the government get in the business of like housing or food, or having the government try to run industries to artificially create traditional jobs and so forth, what you do is you simply give everyone an income and then you let them go out and participate in the market. So it's actually a libertarian approach to having a basic income or a basic safety net. And that's the reason that Friedrich Hayek supported it. So there is a lot of stuff there for conservatives to like if they really have an open mind and think about this as a particular approach to take in the future.
Well, there's a lot of stuff in your book for a lot of folks to ponder, and I'll again give the name of the book. It's Rise of the Robots, Technology and the Threat of a Jobless Future. Martin Ford, I want to thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you very much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Martin Ford. Next week, CNN's national security analyst Peter Bergen, author of United States of Jihad, Investigating America's Homegrown Terrorists. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. To listen to previous interviews anytime, including my recent conversation with New York Times columnist David Brooks, download our free app. You'll find it at Google Play and the iTunes App Store. Search for Reader's Corner.